Greetings, Tacoma. John Doherty here once again for KTAH 101.9's Climate Talk, the place where we talk about everything climate, always respectfully, of course. So today, let's start off by talking about, let's say Taiwan. I hear you querying Taiwan. What's Taiwan got to do with climate? Well, let's see if I can connect the dots here a bit. Right now, we're in the middle of the COVID-19 pandemic. Taiwan is a part of that in a very minor way, a country of 24 million people, just 80 miles off the coast of China. Yet the stats are dumbfounding. So far in Taiwan, there have been 10 deaths attributed to coronavirus. Right now, deaths in the United States, population 350 million or so, somewhere north of 125,000 deaths. How could Taiwan have done so well and we have done so poorly? Although I'll just say parenthetically here, plenty of countries around the world have done poorly. We're sort of in the middle of the pack in terms of how we're doing in terms of managing this pandemic. So why has Taiwan gotten it so right? Well, Taiwan was hit badly by, I believe it was the SARS epidemic back in the early 2000s. And unlike a lot of countries, they took the message to heart and created an infrastructure that was specifically designed to deal with the outbreak of a pandemic. Now, they knew from their own experience, and the reality is that everybody everywhere knew that pandemics came along, that they could be devastating, and that there are ways of managing them. Taiwan took on those ways. Most of the rest of the world did not. By the way, just another stat that shows how poorly we're doing in the United States. We have 4% of the world's population and 25% of the world's deaths from the COVID. What this all points to is that humanity seems to have a preference for ignoring high-risk events, especially ones that seem like they're low probability. When person A gets up in the morning, are they worried about a possible pandemic? Or are they worried about what's going to go on at work today or the relationship with a spouse or something like that? We think in terms of the short timeline, not the long timeline. And these massive events, these super events that create such chaos and damage are guaranteed to come, whether they're earthquakes, massive volcano eruptions, massive typhoons or hurricanes, they're all guaranteed to come, although by their definition, they are unlikely events, events that happen once every 100 years or so. So that means like this year, there's a 1% chance of that happening. And most people will say, well, forget it. I'm not going to plan for something that's only got a 1% chance of happening. Yet it is going to happen. And without planning, the consequences are going to be far worse than they need to be. One of the ironies of this is that the short-sighted point of view costs way more in terms of cleaning up messes after the fact than it would cost to prepare for them in the first place. Some time ago, I mentioned a culvert system in the state of Washington that's interfered drastically with the return of salmon populations. The cost of cleaning up those culverts that don't work for the fish is big. Having done it right in the first place would have been small. Just a simple and small-scale example of what we're talking about here. So we knew that the pandemic was coming. We knew what we needed to do about it, yet we didn't do it. And I gotta say, that's pretty much like what's going on with climate. We know climate change is coming. That is beyond doubt at this point. And we know what to do about it. Not simple, many-faceted, but we know what to do about it. If there's a cause, then we can find a solution, but we're not doing that either. So let's take a look at some of the recent evidence of climate change, what it's doing. There's a city in Siberia called Verkhoyansk, which is just above the Arctic Circle. They recently had a temperature over 100 degrees Fahrenheit, unheard of, record temperature of all time up there. In December, the average temperatures in Siberia have been 18 degrees above normal. So it's not just an isolated event, it's what's going on there in general. Now, most of Siberia is made up of permafrost. That's ground that's frozen permanently, and it doesn't thaw, at least under normal circumstances. When it thaws, it does make an awful mess. Ground collapses, viruses that are 10,000 years old are released back into the atmosphere and so on. And there's another thing that's even worse, makes things even worse, and that is that as the permafrost thaws, it releases methane, which is a very potent greenhouse gas, so it's got kind of a double whammy. As the permafrost thaws, it makes it more likely that more permafrost is going to thaw. There was just recently an event in the city of Norilsk, which is the northernmost city in the world, by the way. They do a lot of extraction up there, gas and so on. And they had a large oil storage tank there that collapsed because the permafrost underneath it had collapsed, and it released 150,000 barrels of diesel fuel into a local river, the largest that they have ever experienced in that part of. Now, diesel is a particularly difficult petroleum product to manage once it gets out into the water. It lasts for a long time. It's really hard to capture, and this diesel is almost certainly going to end up out in the Arctic Ocean, where it's going to contaminate fish and other wildlife. And so we're all going to experience the negative effects of that spill in ways large or small. There are wildfires in the Arctic, in Siberia. The smoke can be seen spreading for thousands of miles, and it's been photographed from space regularly. Huge fires. So massive climate change data showing up in the Siberian region of Russia. This is real. It's happening. It's happening right now. So let's get back to the part where we know what to do, but we're not doing it, and ask the question, well, why is that? George Mason University regularly polls opinion in the United States on climate change. And recent polling shows that 6 in 10 Americans understand global warming is human-caused, and there are only 4 out of 10 who say it's due to natural causes. So demographically speaking, the numbers are there. A significant majority of Americans understand that the climate is changing and that human beings are causing it, yet our political system is headed pretty much in the opposite direction. And I think there's a subset implication here, and that is that blaming climate science deniers really isn't going to get us to where we want to be. We already have the numbers, and my belief is that if somebody's a hardcore denier, they're not going to change their mind, and we're not going to waste our time trying to get them to change their mind. We already have the numbers of people to move politically, but we're not. The reality is that we have way more numbers than we need to make cultural, social, political change related to climate change. There's a political scientist from Harvard University named Erica Chenoweth. She did considerable research in the early 2000s, asking questions about the effectiveness of nonviolent political action. And her finding, duplicated in a number of different circumstances, was that it only takes 3.5% of the population with passion and energy taking action politically to bring about significant change. And I gotta say, the deniers really seem to understand this. While they are a very small minority, I'll say the vocal deniers, maybe 10% or less of the total population, they are passionate, they believe strongly in their point of view, and they've had a way outsized influence in what the direction of our political system is regarding climate change. There's an anthropologist, I think he is, named Jared Diamond, highly respected, and he's written a book that's called Collapse, where he's actually gone back and studied a number of civilizations that have flourished for a while and then they've collapsed, and asking the very important question, why did they collapse? Well, one of the interesting things is that in many cases, climate change was a factor in those collapses. Of course, those were more localized back then because the Earth's climate was relatively stable as a whole, but there were places that were impacted by extensive droughts or flooding or some such natural cause that was out of the bounds of what that particular society had been built on. Well, that threat has been multiplied many times over because the entire Earth is going to be severely impacted by climate change. And that's going to show up in different ways in different places. Some places are going to have less precipitation, other places more. The species are going to migrate. With those implications, the ocean's going to become more acidic. So opportunity after opportunity for bad things to happen. Now, there's no need for despair because Jared Diamond and his research also found societies who were able to weather, so to speak, the changes that they had to deal with, not only climate, of course, other changes like volcanic eruptions or invasions by neighboring societies, those kind of things. But societies can weather massive disruption. And we, as an Earth-wide society, can weather the disruption of climate change. First, the evidence that he looked at called for long-term planning. And he's calling that, and I'm quoting here, the courage to practice long-term thinking and to make bold, courageous, anticipatory decisions at a time when problems have become perceptible before they have reached crisis proportions. So that's exactly where we are right now. We know about climate change. It is perceptible, and it hasn't reached crisis proportions, at least on a worldwide basis, which is not to say that some folks in certain areas have already experienced the crisis as they're going to experience more. If I could refer back to the COVID example, which is a real-time example for us in terms of long-term planning, we totally, as a political system in the United States, abandoned long-term planning for a pandemic, even though we knew it was coming. We were still unable to do that long-term planning. It just seems to be a part of human nature that we're reluctant to do long-term planning. And I would say it's up to the 3.5% or whatever that number should turn out to be to make sure that we are on track to do the long-term planning for climate change. So the second thing that Diamond points to in avoiding collapse, and in this case we're talking about worldwide political, economic, social collapse, is the willingness to reconsider core values. Man, what a big one that is. So once again, I'd like to quote what he means by that. He says, that's the courage to make painful decisions about values. Which of the values that formerly served a society well can continue to be maintained under new changed circumstances? Which of these treasured values must instead be jettisoned and replaced with different approaches? So one of the things that I can see here is that our society in particular values the idea of the earth being here for us to exploit, to extract the stuff out of it, to cut down the trees, to use the rivers and oceans and lakes in whatever way we want without regard to the long-term impact on those various things. That's a treasured value. And when we start restricting folks' ability to follow those values, there's significant pushback. So that's just one example of a value that we have to take a second look at. And there are lots of personal things that are personally held values. The idea of jumping on a jet and going to visit a family member somewhere, or more significantly yet, just sitting back and letting the political process flow as it might without our personal interventions. The value of privacy, the value of, okay, I just want to focus on my own life and not worry about what's going on elsewhere. And of course, one of the most significant values we hold as a society is the idea that we want GDP to be ever constantly growing, and that that concern, that desire, that wish takes precedence over taking care of our environment, an environment that is necessary for our success in any kind of terms. So what to do? Well, I think it's pretty clear. First off, we have to look at our own personal behaviors. I'll have in the show notes on a website I'm going to give you here in a minute, my document, 100 Ways to Reduce Your Carbon Footprint. You can take a look at that and start making additional efforts. I know you've been taking efforts already, but additional efforts to make a difference in terms of your own fossil fuel output. But the second part, and for me, by far the most important part, is the idea of being politically active. We can't just sit back if we know what's going on and let it happen. And the more we change our individual behaviors and the more we become involved politically, the more impact we have and the deeper our understanding of what's going on becomes. Who to join with is up to you. There are lots of great organizations, local, national, and worldwide. And so I'll leave it up to you to seek them out. I will put in a plug for the organization that I'm active with, which is the Citizens Climate Lobby. We're a national organization with a national focus on putting a price on carbon emissions. CitizensClimateLobby.org is the place you can find it nationally or locally, cCLTacoma.org. And I am going to have show notes on that cCLTacoma.org website for Chenoweth and Diamond both, so give you a shortcut to looking up and learning more about what those folks had to say. And I want to touch just again on the subject of optimism versus pessimism. What I would really call for is understanding what's going on as deeply as we possibly can. Sometimes that stuff is scary, and folks tend to call that a gloomy or a pessimistic approach, when really it's just facing up to what the realities are. But there's the promise of lots of really good stuff, too. I'd recommend a guy named Tony Seba to you. He's a visionary who looks at the future of clean energy in an economist, entrepreneurial kind of way. And a lot of the things that he sees out there waiting for us are not only exciting and fun, but create a world that's more livable than the one we're creating right now. And just a little side note here, I finish up my programs by calling on us to live like the mountain is out. And really, isn't that an optimistic look at things? In the middle of the winter, when it's rainy and gloomy, we know that mountain's there. And when it's out, we love it. So let's be real about what's going on. Let's be real about what the possible downside is. But also, let's be real about what the likelihood or possibility of a beautiful future is. I'd love to hear from you, John, J-O-H-N, at cCLTacoma.org. So that's it for today. Once again, I'm reminding you, as always, live like the mountain is out. Take care now.